Well, my name is Stanley Laham, and my doctoral dissertation at the University of Florida, 1978, for the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases, which is now Immunology and Molecular Biology. They changed the name of the department. Was the discovery of a new virus of the viral family Retroviridae, subfamily Spumavirini, in 1978. My proposed thesis was on the origin of antibody specificity, how antibodies acquire specificity. But back then, they didn't want to fund that research. So my doctoral dissertation ended up to be in virology. And like I said, the discovery of a new virus.
There are some people now who say that viruses don't exist. Now, this is one of those things that we have to sort of put up with, I think, now in the post-truth world. But is there anything you can cite? Because obviously these things are tiny to prove they are.
Yeah, well, first of all, we know that they exist because we know first the maladies that they cause, two, that they are contagious, that they can be transferred from person to person, and that they are infectious, that they spread from the point of entry to the rest of the body. Before viruses were discovered, obviously bacteria were discovered first, and yeasts, fungi, and everything. The first name that was given, that they were given, was filtrated viruses. In other words, filtration systems that could filtrate out bacteria did not filtrate out these infectious entities. And then gradually we discovered them. We discovered their mode of replication. We can see them. We can see the actual virus on electron microscopy. We can see their effect. We can see how they cause sometimes cell nuclei to fuse together, causing what we call syncytia. And we have pretty well discovered everything about viral diseases, from the portal of entry to the pathogenesis to the end. So I don't know how they can be doubted. How it can be doubted that they exist. Some people doubt that they exist because they don't have their own replicative mechanism. So they are obligate intracellular parasites because they use the cell's own replicative mechanism in order to reproduce themselves. They are the perfect colonizers. If you want to make the comparison, they are settlers that take over the cell, take over its replicative mechanism to produce more of themselves and propagate throughout the organism.
Now, we've now got Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as the US Health Secretary. He was very against much of what's been going on over the years with the pharmaceutical industry. He's been a lawyer against big corporate lobby groups of all sorts, actually, well, many sorts. And he's just announced the cutting of $500 million in funding for these mRNA vaccines. Now, this really is the cutting edge of medicine, many say, Stanley. The idea is that there could be all sorts of cures here. Now, I mean, surely cutting $500 million from the research budget is reckless.
Well, he's cutting off research, funding for research on mRNA vaccines, not on RNA or mRNA or transfer RNA or immune RNA. And these companies that he's cutting funding from are almost trillion-dollar companies now. They have raked incredible fortunes during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I don't, and this was the big unfair thing during that pandemic. We subsidized their research. We subsidized the manufacturing of the mRNA vaccines. And then they were given the fast track permission to go ahead without adequate testing to put those vaccines out and raked in literally hundreds of billions of dollars without ever spending themselves any money in research and development. The research and development was totally funded by taxpayers. So I don't think they can complain. It was a huge mistake by President Trump to give them this fast track permission and immunity from civil or criminal prosecution if their product was either unwittingly or knowingly harmful. And as I had predicted before they came out, when it was announced that an mRNA vaccine, I obviously knew they would take the messenger RNA that codes for the spike protein of the coronavirus, inject it into people, and hoping that that messenger RNA would be translated into antibodies, would be translated into the spike protein, migrate to cell membranes, and then your body would make antibodies to that protein that's being made by your cells instead of the virus itself. That's the whole idea of an mRNA vaccine. And this way, you would become immune to the virus once you're infected by the virus. Even theoretically, knowing what we know about what can happen to a piece of messenger RNA, it was flawed. And it did turn out to be flawed. The simple reason is that people getting the vaccine were still getting COVID and were being hit by a bunch of new mRNA for variants that were coming up. So this is one big, should have been a veto on an mRNA vaccine because we knew in advance that it would be producing just one specific type of antibody, that any slight mutation in the RNA of that virus, which is a positive strand, single strand RNA virus, can cause a change in that spike protein that makes it immune to the original mRNA that you used as a vaccine. And that's why they have had to make so many variant vaccines and boosters because they were ineffective. To argue that they were effective, is a slap in the face of reality because they weren't. It was proven not to be. That's why they had to make so many new boosters, and every time a new variant would appear, try to make a new mRNA vaccine against the new variant. And for people who say that is normal, I would like to posit this. Polio is a single-stranded positive RNA virus. When the vaccine, the for it, two types were developed, one we call the Sabin vaccine and the other one the Salk vaccine. For 50 years, first of all, it eradicated polio. And for over half a century, we never heard of variants coming up. Did we? We never heard, well, we must make a new polio vaccine because a new variant popped up in Africa or in Mongolia or somewhere, because they were well thought of vaccines that what you would call multivalent vaccine that cause both multivalent antibody response and cellular immunity response. Something that mRNA vaccines could never do. So why did they make the mRNA vaccines? Because they're easy to do. And it doesn't take 7, 8 years of testing and of research before you put it out.
A lot of journalists are trotting out this mRNA, RNA, these sorts of code words. I don't think most of them even understand what RNA and mRNA really means. Can you explain how these types of vaccines differ from traditional vaccines? I mean, we're in Bristol here, right close to Gloucestershire, where Edward Jenner, around about 1800, was experimenting with the world's first vaccines. But these are these mRNA are human engineered ones. His were natural. And so what makes these things different? And what do these messenger RNA, mRNA, what does it stand for? What does it mean? I think actually the other thing, of course, is people have heard about DNA. DNA being the code which codifies life. And which all cells use when they're replicating. So, can you just explain some of these terms and how they're different from Edward Jenner style vaccines?
Sure. Edward Jenner's style vaccine is that he took, cowpox viruses, scratched it on people, and it was so similar to human smallpox virus that the antibodies you made to them, to that scratch, were effective. To a certain degree, to a large degree, against smallpox itself. But he was inoculating people with whole smallpox, with whole cowpox virion, the whole particle. So therefore, you developed, not only what they used to call humoral immunity, which is antibody that circulate in the serum, but many different types of antibodies to that virus, and also it stimulated cellular immunity, T cell immunity. Now, you're talking about people, the mRNA. I have to explain then in that case what mRNA is. You mentioned that life comes from DNA, it is the genetic material that determines who we are, what we are. But how does DNA does that? DNA is not expressed directly as the product of, it doesn't go from genes to expression. This DNA has to be transcribed by what we call RNA-dependent DNA polymerase. So our DNA, the DNA of our genes, go through what they call messenger RNA that is transcribed from that DNA. That's why they call it messenger RNA. And that's the messenger RNA that is now translated into the various proteins that the cells, manufacture, fabricate. So DNA goes from DNA to messenger RNA through transcription, and from messenger RNA to protein by translation. This is what is called the central dogma that Crick proclaimed back in 1957. And unfortunately, they call it the central dogma. I don't want to veer from the conversation, but I think dogmas should only exist in religion, not in science, because they're easily, we find out after a certain amount of time that it doesn't necessarily to go through that path. And RNA viruses, Crick and Watson would have been surprised about the discovery of reverse transcriptase, which is what permits RNA viruses like polio or like the coronavirus that we call COVID-19 to replicate. Because once they get into the cell, they're RNA viruses, and the RNA is not going to replicate by itself. There is a new pathway that went against the central dogma, which was discovered by Temin in Baltimore back in 1976. That's when we discovered reverse transcriptase that can reverse the chain DNA to RNA, RNA to DNA. And reverse transcriptase can take RNA and make the corresponding DNA for it. And that DNA can be incorporated into the cell's DNA.
Right, and Mike. Okay, so what? Let me just try and clarify what you're saying, because it sounds to me what you're saying is the DNA contains a whole series of codes, and for a specific action in a cell, the code is translated into, or it's an RNA. Which is copied from the DNA for a specific purpose, and then
And that's the messenger RNA.
that's mRNA. Then goes and manufactures a protein of some sort, and builds the cell. But the reverse transcriptase is doing something in the opposite direction. So that is when it's finding something out there. I mean, this is actually quite dangerous, isn't it? It could be potentially dangerous if it finds the wrong thing and it starts translating that into the DNA. It could create havoc and maybe cause some sort of mutation if it's something from the outside which is coming in to alter the DNA, because the DNA, it seems to me, is the sort of the most important code which is being passed from one person to another. If someone starts interfering with that, then they should be rather careful.
That is correct. And DNAs are chromosomes, storage for DNA, which has all the information that is passed along to our progeny, that determines whether your kid is going to be a white, black, Chinese, African, Mongolian, whatever, that is stored in the DNA. Whether your eyes are going to be brown, blue, green, I don't know. That is stored in the DNA. The shape of your head, the shape of your nose, the length of your arm, your height, that is stored in your DNA. This is the genetic information that is passed on from generation to generation,
Yeah,
and
but
it is.
there was for many years, Francis Galton and his friends said a bit more than that, didn't they? They said also part of the encoding in the DNA is for intelligence, strength, physical strength, all these sorts of qualities that they saw in a sort of a master race. So I wonder what you make of that.
Well, we haven't, there isn't a gene marked intelligence. There are genes, obviously, our genetic material determines the size of our brain, the shape of our brain, but there isn't a gene for intelligence. What we acquire from outside and record in the brain, and this is more for a neurologist than for me to discuss, influences knowledge as much as what is inherited. Intelligence can be acquired, trained, And you're seeing that now with the advances in artificial intelligence. Obviously, there's no DNA involved in that. And our brain, the neurons of our brain, can do things that even supercomputers, though they can do much faster, but there are things that they cannot do. Now, as far as whether DNA determines emotions, I don't know.
Yeah, I
But
mean, a lot of this eugenics is being discredited too. I mean, particularly after the Nazi era. But anyway, look, getting back to the modern world, what do you make of the pharmaceutical lobby? Because they're very upset about having all this money pulled from them, and they're making a big fuss. Certainly here in the UK, we've got great complaints saying, you know, that actually this is a whole area of there's all sorts of diseases which can be nipped in the bud by this, potentially anyway, by this new technology.
no, I don't think he's taking funding out of the technology of the mRNA technology. He's taking out funding out of the mRNA vaccine project. Now, if you can use messenger RNA for other purposes, and there are other purposes for messenger RNA, that is fine. What RFK Jr. is doing is defunding. And the big pharma research in mRNA vaccines, they can still do it. They have enough money to do it. Personally, I would go a step further. I would require years, like the polio vaccine that was, both of them were tested for between 7 and 8 years, to make sure that there were no side effects before they came. Same for the smallpox. They have to be, we know that they're not as effective. And I gave you that example. I mean, just compare the vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, and the multitude of variants that came, that were produced, to the traditional vaccines like the polio or smallpox vaccine. How many variant polios have you heard of? How many variant smallpox viruses have you heard of?
Well, zero. But I mean, I have seen a very interesting talk by the London doctor Andrew Wakefield at Stanley. It'd be interesting to know if you've seen it and what you make of it, where he actually says that in the 1970s, through the really no, there being no vaccine to it at all, measles had pretty much died out as a disease. It was caught by young children. To whom it had, you know, maybe they'd have to have a week off school or something. I think they're talking about sort of 7, 8 year old kids. And they were, it was certainly very, very, very unlikely to be fatal, maybe 0.0001%. The kids got ill, but then they got immune to it for the rest of their lives. And now apparently there's been a resurgence since the introduction of measles vaccine. So is that feasible? Is that possible?
Well, I don't want to pontificate on something that I am not deadly sure of, but I can tell you that the measles vaccine, there was a famous case when my kids were in school where there was an outbreak of measles when they were in elementary school. That's in late 80s, early 90s, where most of the popul of the school was vaccinated, and we still had a measles outbreak. So this was something, that was surprising. And I did not study that, in detail, but it seems that we had less measles in the 70s than we had in the 90s. As far as the vaccines are concerned, and something that should be argued, is that now we have kids being challenged with close to 70 different antigens. When my granddaughter was going to get her first set of vaccines, I went with my daughter, and it was, I have to tell you, when my daughter was getting vaccinated, it was just the DPT. Diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. That was the first injection, 2 or 3 months old. Whereas when I got there, it was an injection for seven different antigens for seven different diseases. And I asked the pediatrician, who was a lady, I said, "Look, is that a good idea to be challenging two and a half month old baby whose immune system still depends on some passive immunity from the mother with seven, you're challenging the immune system with seven different antigen in the same injection. Aren't you overwhelming the immune system of a young kid?" And she says, "Well, this is what the Pediatrics Association of America recommend." I said, "No, but you know a little bit of immunology, don't you find that?" Said, "Well, we are allowed to separate them, but then the insurance won't pay for it." That's kind of a strange answer, don't you think?
Oh God, yes.
And it's true. You can ask, you can find out. I don't know how it is in England, but here in the US, you can say, "Okay, no, I don't want them all together. I want it separately." But then the insurance will not cover it.
Interesting. Well, look, finally, I wonder if you can just sum up. I know it's a difficult thing to do in a nutshell, Stanley, how an mRNA vaccine actually works. What is what does it actually do once it's put into your body? I say it works because sometimes obviously it doesn't work, but what is it, how is it supposed to work?
Okay, how it's supposed to work, ideally, and that's what the big pharma wanted us to believe, and they hid some of their data, by the way, and that's why the FDA, it will take, at the rate that they're releasing the licensing documents that they were, it will take approximately, before it was 75 years, they activated it. Now it'll take about 40 years before all these documents are out. I think it's something like 200 pages a day or something like that. And there are hundreds of thousands of pages. The way it's ideally supposed to work, you're injected with an mRNA strand, which is protected with nanolipid particles and ethylene glycol particles. Ethylene glycol is what you use as antifreeze in your car. And it's supposed to remain at the site of injection, which is the first bowl, infect the cells where it is injected. These cells are supposed to, let's say, in the muscle, in the arm muscle where it's injected, these cells are supposed to take in that mRNA and start translating it into the spike protein of the COVID virus. These proteins, spike proteins, migrate to the outer membrane of those muscle cells. Your immune system is supposed to recognize them as foreign, mount an antibody response and make antibodies against them, attack those muscle cells that are expressing the COVID antigen, and you've become now you and you make memory B lymphocytes that will already have the information so that if you get COVID, they automatically start producing, they don't have to go through the recognition, and that's what vaccines are all about. They don't have to go through the recognition process of a foreign antigen and start at step zero. They start at step 10 and start producing antibodies immediately. That's the idea of how it's supposed to
Well,
work.
okay, so the idea is it's supposed to train your body, but the fact is, of course, that this stuff remains in your body. Quite often it doesn't stay in the cells, and it can potentially stay around and
The
continue.
obvious thing, the thing that was obvious to me, why did I write that it was a bad idea before the vaccines even came out? That it would not stay at the site of injection. There is no way that you can guarantee that it will stay. It will circulate, it will be distributed, it will be picked up by hepatic cells, kidney cells, heart cells. It will be picked up, as you know, randomly by cells around your body. And these cells may have a 50% chance of starting to produce that antigen, that viral antigen. So what happens if some heart muscle cells that picked up some of that mRNA start producing, the spike protein? You're going to get an immune response against those cardiac muscles, and you're gonna get some myocarditis.
Okay, Stanley Lehame, thanks very much for joining us once more.
You're welcome, Tony.